All views expressed in this podcast are our own. We are not financial planners, investment advisors, or tax advisors. The views that we have on this show do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the people who sign our paychecks. So please keep that in mind and always, always consult a trained financial professional before you start moving your hard-earned money. Let's dive in.
All right. So what are we doing today?
Protecting vault technology. And Chance, breaking down the fourth wall. You and I had very different takes on this. So I would love to hear, what is your coming into this without ever having met David of LenderFit before? What is your take on technology and lending? I want to hear from Chance.
First thing, here's the problem with breaking down the fourth wall. It's like you've just invited a vampire into your homes.
That's not the question, Chance. Answer the question. That's not your reporting. You are part of this discussion.
Well, I guess second first thing. Hi, world. My name is Chance. I am the producer of this show. I was not expecting to speak to everyone today. But to start,
my take on technology and lending, I am pretty much a Luddite when it comes to all technology. I generally prefer people-centric operations because most often I find that it's just a tool to get done what you were trying to do anyway. It's best to start from solid first principles and then try and integrate technology. It doesn't have any soul. If you're trying to find like a more equitable solution to something, I don't think you're going to find it in technology.
Why don't you think you'll find equity in technology or an equitable solution in technology?
So take for an example, you can have as many different lending platforms as you want, or a lender can integrate as many different lending platforms as he or she wants into their systems. But if the lender's reporting requirements that they set up for integrating that technical solution to whatever it is they're trying to do were not equitable to begin with, they're looking for too many reports. They have a too stringent idea of what risk is. Then whatever technology they integrate is just going to increase their capacity for doing what they already wanted to do, which could be good, could be bad. Most often in this economy, I find generally pretty bad.
When I was thinking about the hook for this, it was like, and Leah, I listened to that YouTube, the VCC learning that she sent over, and I was really struck by that sentiment of technology is not good, technology is not bad, but people make it so. And it really goes into Chance what you were saying about technology is a tool that can accelerate whatever you're doing. If you're doing good, it can accelerate good. If you're doing bad, it can accelerate bad. And how do we create technology that accelerates good for capital? I think that's a pretty cool topic to get to talk about, especially in the past few years, because technology comes up a lot now in community lending. And how do we get dollars into our community and what's stalling it and how do we do it faster? And technology often comes up as here's a solution. And to Chance's point, let's go through how are we doing the people and the processes first and then get to technology? And then like some community lenders are like, nope, we're at the people. We don't need technology, or we just don't want to or can't invest in technology. And some people are very like, technology is not our friend. Let's not bring technology into this. So it's a very timely topic of can technology be used for good, or is it the enemy? My personal stance is that it can be used for good, but that technology and data is not objective. It's just not, because it's built by people, and technology and data absorbs the biases of the people who make it. And so if you can have technology that is absorbing good community-driven insights, that's fantastic. But how do you build out a technology that has that? I don't know. What do you think, Leah, Ebony?
Yeah, I agree with kind of where Chance started. The system can either perpetuate, you know, that system of bias and the criteria that's built, to your point, Andrea, by a human with those biases and stuff, whether they're aware of them or not, or it's a criteria given to them from the industry they're in, or they've just never had that lived experience. So like I think about Snagajob It's a huge, you know, recruiting tool for kind of hourly wage jobs. And so even how those applications are built and boxes like gender, how are they dealing with gender on an application for an employer like McDonald's or Sheetz or something like that? Like, someone on the design, technology design side has to be aware that not everybody identifies with one gender or another and has to say, oh, we should add that to an application because someone would click a different box. If there's not awareness from the humans building the tech, then those biases or the lack of inclusion will just continue. I think that's universal. And yes, we're going to talk to David about, you know, the uniqueness of kind of the capital and the lending world around tech, but in fintech, but I think that human bias is there for good or for bad, regardless of fields.
Building on that point, I remember this study, a huge tech company, this was probably from like a decade ago, who said, you know, we want more women in tech. And so we're going to build a resume reading artificial intelligence to build this so that we get more women applicants and that we prioritize women applicants through this. And it ended up actually pulling out fewer. And it was because the people who built the technology were all men. And so they were putting in like, here's the schools that we want to see our applicants from. And like the schools were matched with the schools that they went to. And here's the like experience we want them to have. And those experiences were the same experiences that the men who built the platform had experiences in. And the AI spit out fewer women applicants because there was nobody, no human being sitting in there going, actually, we need more women applicants. Like, we've got to like pull in more women applicants. And to me, that was a really remarkable story about technology is not the solution unless you are really intentional around how you're using technology and willing to really challenge your own notions of what is something that we are prioritizing in this and being intentional about.
For someone who has a weird relationship with technology, like I use it, but I'm not like, it's not my natural gift. I want to play devil's advocate in that I know of some people who wanted to, let's say, work with a CDFI and they wanted to get a loan from a CDFI. And they reached out to them and they couldn't get hold of anyone. They couldn't, like, no one was calling them back. It was not the best customer service experience. And I'm just being honest with you. And I think a lot of times people, and I've heard it phrased, and I think it's something the CDFI community has to deal with internally, but they are often, you know, classify themselves as the last resort for many of the people that we serve. And as a result, that does not mean that these communities don't get those benefit of actually working with the technology that they've grown accustomed to in other industries and other areas of their life. And I think technology, you know, sometimes people view it as a luxury. At this point, I don't think it's a luxury in our country. I think it's a necessity. Not having certain levels of technology, I feel, can really impede the type of impact that we want to have, because people will just walk away. And not only, if I'm being honest too, like, I hate, you know, Wells Fargo doesn't have the best track record with many people. But if I'm honest, they got the technology for days. They have the technology that can get people in and out to a point where I know people, they can get a much better rate at a CDFI, but because they struggle with the service that they receive, or like somebody responding to them, or why do I have to drive 20 miles in order to sign a form? Why can't you just send that to me electronically? They're like, it's not worth it. And in the long run, are you really building generational wealth if families are paying these much higher rates if they get a loan at all at these other companies? But at the same time, I recognize that it's a hard battle, because we don't have the resources that Wells Fargo has to put towards that. So I don't know the answer. I'm just acknowledging that I do think technology plays a role in giving these giving our customers the service that is served with dignity.
Today, we're talking to David Tolliver. He's the founder of LenderFit, a technology company that helps lenders connect with small business owners, that listens to the small business owners. And what do they need for this to be successful? And listens to the lender. What do they need for this to be successful? And connects the dots. And we do want to be upfront and transparent that David from LenderFit is our lead sponsor for this season. Thank you, LenderFit. We're very excited. But we asked them to be our sponsor because of the great work that they're doing. And we want David to talk more about that today. But want to be fully transparent that they're our lead sponsor and we're incredibly grateful. And we hope that you appreciate what he's saying and what he's coming from. But let us know, if not, what you're thinking about and what your reactions are.
This is Ebony Perkins.
This is Leah Freemow.
This is Andrea Longton. We are Renegade Capital. And today we're talking about technology and community lending. Is it good? Is it bad? What are we doing about it? Let's dive in. Renegade Capital is proud to be sponsored by LenderFit. LenderFit is technology for community lenders. Done right. I first fell in love with LenderFit when I realized that it broke down obstacles for small business owners seeking capital by listening to the communities it serves. LenderFit transforms loan applications into projects. The technology streamlines applications and supports customers on their own terms. It meets them where they are. 98% of LenderFit's clients are CDFIs and nonprofit lenders. Thank you for being Season 2's lead sponsor. Visit LenderFit.io for more information about how your CDFI can transform its capacity. So, by way of introduction, can you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about LenderFit, what it is, what you do, and a borrower story that sticks with you.
Sure. Yeah, my name's David Tolliver. I'm the founder of LenderFit. Since about 2013, I've been working on access to equitable capital solutions, whether it's loan funds or the technology that comes along with it. And so LenderFit was born a few years back, and it was really rooted in a lot of the experiences that I'd had with working with small business owners and trying to understand the mindset of a small business owner and what they were thinking and what they were going through when they were applying for capital. And just realizing that the majority of the technology that's out there has really been designed really well to suit the lender's needs, but maybe not make it so easy on the small business to be able to apply. As far as the story goes, one that I think is probably a good primer to get started here is about a borrower that I worked with here in Louisville, Kentucky, named Sherry Hurley. And she's a caterer. We made loans to quite a few caterers. Pre-LenderFit ran a growth loan program here. We worked with Sherry. She had received a Kiva loan, and I've been involved with helping Kiva around the country as well. And so oftentimes we would have applicants go do Kiva first and then come to the growth loan and then go do Kiva again and then look for other capital. And so, Sherry's story was like that. She started out with a Kiva loan, came in for a growth loan. The growth loan was up to 35K, and then she could go back for another Kiva loan for about 10 grand. And so we just started to get to know each other over the years. From those experiences, either helping her on Kiva or with the growth loan. And I knew that she also had several kind of personal loans around town and had been doing well with all of these. Everybody loves the business. It's called Farm to Fork Catering. She works with local farmers. Food's amazing. Great company. We have an event in Louisville called the Derby.
Woohoo!
Yeah. And so
With horses? What is it now?
Yeah, with horses.
Okay.
And during the Derby, groups like Microsoft would call her up to try to, have her cater their events. And she became a 20 or 30 person employer in peak times and, still had a good sized staff even outside of the Derby. And so
peak times, by the way, is the first Saturday in May.
That's right. So. That's right. And so, so just repeatedly, time and time again, making good on these loans, paying her friends and family back, paying Kiva back, paying the growth loan back, paying Kiva back again. And, one of the journeys that I tried to get all of our borrowers on was to see if they could get a line of credit at a local bank. And so she had gone around to a couple different banks and kept hearing no. And I was just perplexed. So I asked if I could go with her to the next bank meeting. And so We met at the bank and I think she was a little nervous, and we went in and we sat in the lobby, big, nice building. Someone comes out in a suit and tie and we go into a conference room and just start asking questions about the business, and pretty quickly some questions around the financials of the business. And what I learned from working with so many businesses like Sherry was I could sit down and she could explain the business in great detail and understood her finances, could create value, could create jobs, but didn't necessarily speak bank speak. And so when the questions came out around the finances, it was, well, here's my QuickBooks, you know, spin it around. And do you have what you need just by looking at my QuickBooks account? Which isn't possible in a brief meeting like that. You can't just kind of poke around someone's QuickBooks account. So, you know, the line of conversation just kind of changed, and then that opportunity sort of fizzled out. You know, time and time again, she was turned down by banks, and eventually that led her to take an online loan from kind of a merchant cash advance type group with, you know, 50, 60% APR. And, you know, this amazing, thriving small business that everybody loved all of a sudden had this enormous burden of multiple thousands of dollars a month, you know, payments on this loan product. And it made me kind of angry. You know, here I am trying to help small businesses and help these owners grow and get things started. Someone somewhere made Sherry a loan and they don't really care if she defaulted or not. And she's got all these jobs that she's creating and all this value that she's creating for the community. And so, but she made it. She made it through. She was able to fight kind of tooth and nail and pay that off. And then recently she made it through, you know, all of the COVID issues that restaurants have had and caterers have had. I talked to her a few weeks ago, and I think that she's coming out on the other side of COVID even stronger. But still, I don't know that she has a line of credit with the bank. So that was one of the stories that was really formative as we thought about what LenderFit could be, because here I had met hundreds of small businesses across the country who were paying loans back, you know, but for whatever reason couldn't qualify with the bank. And even that moment of kind of walking into the bank with Sherry and just kind of feeling some of that nervousness, you know, bankers, I've met a lot of wonderful bankers that would love to make loans. And they're super nice and friendly. And they don't really know that the night before that small business was up all night worried about the conversation they're going to have with them the next day, because they wouldn't be able to perfectly discuss the P&L or the balance sheet. And so we really tried to kind of step into the shoes of the business owner and, you know, empathize with them and say, okay, how can we demystify this process in a way that makes lenders more efficient and increases their capacity, but allows small business owners to have a little bit more empowerment in the process of a little bit of education along the way at the right time, mixed in with just a really easy to understand, you know, 1, 2, 3, this is what you can expect. This is what's going to happen next. So yeah, so we could probably go a lot of different directions from all that, but that's a little bit of a background and a quick, you know, borrower story of that led into some of the things that we're thinking through at LenderFit as we create a solution, not just for lenders, but one that works for small businesses as well.
Can you tease that out a little bit of what would you say are the top 2 or 3 factors that make that customer-centric or an empathy-focused product for small business owners, but also that works for the lenders? What is your secret sauce?
When I was managing applications, a common scenario might be a personal financial statement. And so if someone's applying for a small business loan, they're a little confused when you want to know about their personal finances. And so what happens is they get that list of items and they kind of put off the meeting with you and put off the meeting with you. And then they start to meet with you. And here they had questions about the personal financial statement 2 weeks ago, but they just waited until they were meeting with you to ask those questions. Or maybe there's an FAQ style sheet that you send out, or maybe you ask, you know, some lenders will say, hey, get these 10 things together or send them to me. And I've done this before. I challenge anybody who's listening to this. Now go home at 10 o'clock at night when you put your kids to bed and try to prepare. You know, where do you put the information? Where do you collect it? Do you put it on your desktop? Do you print it out? Are they going to need paper copies? What format do you want? Do they need multiple years of, you know, an income statement in a monthly format? And then all the while you're putting it together, you're wondering, does this even look good? Am I putting my best foot forward? Like, how do I learn how to talk about this? And so really starting to say, okay, how can create more transparency as one aspect of kind of demystifying the process? And then how can we just start treating it like a project? That's one of the biggest things that we talk about is that, you know, most software treats the application like an application portal. and something you just kind of sign in and drop documents off at. And if you can actually create a project, which it is, you're managing data, documents, and communication. Now you can start to create phases and specific checklist items that have nice education or links to additional resources, maybe videos that you've created that explain what exactly you're looking for. You know, most of the small business owners I met, like, they're waiting till 10 o'clock at night, 11 o'clock at night, you know, and that's the only time they work on their application. So if you can have a mobile friendly application or something that's texting them, they can do more during the day. Another reason why they work on it at night is just because they don't have much time. And sometimes I think lenders think that if the applicant drops off the radar for a while, that maybe they're not loan worthy, you know, or like maybe that's a sign of their character. And it's like, no, that's a single parent with three kids and they're trying to run a small business. They're scared and they're busy and they're tired. And so, you know, how can LenderFit provide that kind of gentle nudge, the weekly reminder, the inactivity alerts that the lenders don't really have time to do when they do start to fall away from the application to kind of get them back in? How can we have, you know, those touch points and have the process be kind of rooted in education? You know, the growth loan that I mentioned earlier is a loan program that we created that is up to 35K. I mentioned that, but no collateral, no credit, 1 year of business history. Great repayment rate. And what we realized was that, you know, we could create a more narrative underwriting process, you know, more of a Q&A style, or let's ask some easy questions first. And so again, if you don't treat an application like a project, you can't really have the easy questions first. You're kind of asking for everything all at once, which is, you know, really overwhelming for the applicant.
Renegade Capital is proud to be sponsored by Community Capital Management, or CCM. CCM is an investment firm with over two decades of experience managing impact and ESG investing portfolios. Its mission seeks to deliver superior risk-adjusted returns through investment strategies that contribute to positive environmental and social outcomes. We're really proud to be sponsored by Community Capital Management because its investments look to benefit underserved individuals, families, and communities, including women and minorities. Visit ccminvest.com to learn more.
The work I was doing at BCC, I worked in between the lenders and then the borrowers with the technical assistance. And just, I'm smiling because it's even the lenders that want to take the time to chase the paperwork. And because that's the other piece of this is lenders have goals and then they can't chase down the missing tax form, or they can, but the efficiency is lost. And one lender, well-meaning lender, said, well, Leah, can someone from your TA team sit down with Jenny, you know, during the day and gather all this stuff? And it's like, well, she could, but it's still the business owner that has to go and get the tax documents. And because her experience was, well, I think she's doing this at like 9 or 10 at night. And it's like, yes, she is. That's when she has time to get this stuff together. And what I appreciate about what you're sharing is just kind of, it's more of a holistic approach to both sides of that relationship, and that it is a relationship that you're trying to build between the borrower and the lender, because the lender has to turn around and explain the deal to people that have never even met the borrower. And so setting them up for the best presentation for that credit or for that person going forward too. It's like they're more prepared because they have the whole project in front of them and not just documents, you know?
Yeah. And a lot of times in the middle of the application, you kind of disappear into a black box. You send information in, you don't hear back for 2 or 3 weeks. You think maybe you're halfway done. That would happen a lot too. Maybe we had an intake form and they'd fill out the intake form and I'd get an email 2 days later. And it's like, hey, when do you think I'll get my check? And it's like, well, there's a few more steps here. And so, how do you create a palatable way for them to kind of see the work that lies ahead, not get too intimidated by it, but really, you know, learn what it's like to apply, not just, you know, what you need in each section. Yeah. And when it comes to the equitable side of this, you know, unfortunately, if you don't have a big team, if you've started small, if you didn't have much resources to get started, it does all fall on your shoulders. And, you know, that's another reason why this is important. You know, during PPP, I think you saw a lot of businesses that were larger, they had big staff, or they had a lot of pre-existing relationships with the banks. And then technology became in and played a role as well. They created a bunch of bottlenecks. You know, there's plenty of news articles about major banks whose systems crashed. And so the people that kind of went to the front of the line were the ones that had dedicated staff to apply and manage that relationship with the bank, or was, you know, was more organized, et cetera. And when I say more organized, I'm not saying because they were a better business owner. you know, they just had more time and resources and staff to be organized. And so it was this perfect mix of, you know, the technology that was already hard to use started to fail. And, you know, the smaller businesses, the more disadvantaged businesses that started, you know, with less to begin with, you know, not only was the technology working against them, but if anything, trying to figure out how to pivot and run a business in the middle of COVID while trying to apply for this, which is interesting too. It's been neat from a national vantage point to kind of see behind the scenes as CDFIs have been reacting and managing COVID. And we had several folks that we work with that shifted into a prep mode specifically to just help small businesses get everything in order. So then they could be that person that walks into the bank that's already knows all of the details and kind of how that application process is going to work.
So David, did you come from a tech background? How did those skills develop into what you're doing today?
Yeah, I always tell people I'm the son of an artist and a database administrator. And so that's my secret power, I guess. And I don't do any of the coding. So early on, I had a little bit of imposter syndrome, I guess, on just thinking, okay, how can I start a tech company if I'm not a coder? But then I started to realize, you know, again, that's kind of a secret advantage. And it allowed us to really focus on kind of humanizing the design and the loan process and working with a lot of other talented people who were a lot of other talented developers and designers. Allowed me to really focus in on making sure that this was a product that was easy to use and to, yeah, just bring more to the table on the experience side. Again, I think one of the reasons why we're at this point where technology is hard to use is because a lot of other startups have done a good job of understanding the bank's problems, but not really understanding the business's problems. And so a lot of really talented people have gone headfirst in that direction and they've, you know, designed great things for the lenders, but they aren't, you know, as compatible for the small businesses. So I think where we started to realize or where I started to realize the power for technology was with the work that I was doing with Kiva. You know, Kiva is an international crowdfunding company. They do a lot of work in the US as well. And so we launched a Kiva community in Louisville, another one in Columbus, Ohio, another one in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And they really had a set platform that was designed for one particular loan product, theirs. But it was designed to be pretty easy to apply and they were doing it. You know, they were getting hundreds and hundreds of small businesses on the platform applying for capital. And that's where, you know, we started to think about the growth loan and how interested people were in that and how and how Kiva had a platform. And it just all started to sort of come together that applications are projects. There's no client-facing project management tool. Businesses are confused and, you know, lenders are struggling to have the capacity to work with them. That's really the background from a technology perspective.
How do you create a team of coders and others who also share that same vision of how do we create this in a way that facilitates this connection between lenders and small business owners? How do you create that culture? Because so often we see technology absorbs the biases of the people who create it, but it also can absorb the, positive biases of the people who create it. How do you train that culture?
Well, we are trying to design technology that's not as parental, I guess, or doesn't necessarily force the people that use it into whatever way we think they should be using it. You know, the reason why a lot of people haven't done this in the commercial lending space before is because everybody does commercial lending differently. And, you know, we have CDFIs that are out there, you know, trying to support the unbanked and underbanked, and they have a lot of unique ways to underwrite things. And so I think from the beginning, the rally cry was, how do we make a platform that people can customize into whatever they need within the lending realm? You know, it's not a platform for anything, you know, like Salesforce or something like that, you know, but it is for lenders to be able to customize applications. And I think a lot of the people working on the project didn't even know that CDFIs existed, pretty common. plenty of freelancers and, you know, small business owners that I've worked with. And I'm like, yeah, so there's this whole layer of nonprofit support for businesses, and there's coaching and there's capital and all this. And they're like, wait, what? I can tap into this thing. And I was like, yeah. And so I think just from a mission perspective, people really gravitate towards that. You know, it's a chance to be involved in something that impacts the financial system in a positive way. And kind of shifts, it kind of equalizes the power, if you will, between a lender and a small business when a small business can feel more confident in talking to the lender. You know, their goals are the same. The lender wants to lend money and the small business wants to get the money. And so how can that conversation be a little bit more of an even playing field without one side needing to feel so nervous?
We had an interesting kind of pre-call before the interview today, and just, you know, technology for good and for bad and all the different continuums. And it comes down to the people developing it. And as Andrea said, the biases that we all carry with us. And so you'll see companies like Snagajob, Capital One, these big tech businesses, tech-based businesses, but they are more aware of their developers and coders' biases of people of privilege or, you know, certain demographics or college backgrounds or whatever. And so are trying to do more to attract talent that may not have a college degree and may not, you know, may be a great coder because they just do it at night and they're high school kids and they have no desires. Like, so are you thinking about kind of your team's diversity and how that's going to influence the development of the tech in a way that is kind of more inclusive and kind of building for the future in a way?
I think there's a lot of really amazing studies out there that show a more diverse team is more successful. And so as a startup, you know, you strive to be as diverse as possible. And we're certainly diverse from a regional perspective and from, I think, an age perspective and working to become even more diverse. And I do think it's kind of twofold where, you know, you look at the design. I think you have to be very design led. I think there's a lot of technology out there that they just want to get it out there and kind of let the developers do all of the building. But I think that when you have a designer and you're taking time and you're being thoughtful and you're doing the discovery with the customers, that's a big hedge against your own biases creeping in. Going back a little bit to kind of how we keep bias out of LenderFit, we're not actually, one of the things we intentionally did was we didn't want to be a robo approver platform. You know, sometimes even CDFIs think, oh, there's so much going on. Is there something that someone could just put their information in it and it would approve it instantly for us? And, you know, as they go down that journey, they're like, well, we still want the relationship with the customer. And it's like, well, what you just said is really not relationship building at all. But then also too, how many of you are willing to actually just let the machine do all of the decisioning and lend out millions of dollars without looking at anything? And so, you know, LenderFit in a lot of ways is just it's simpler than you would think, right? You know, we're allowing people to collect information and to discuss it. We're not actually building any algorithms that's saying, hey, based on how many times someone replies to a text over the course of 6 months and whether they were in their circle or a contact in their contact book. You know, it's basically just saying, hey, I think that we could just make the normal application process better. And more organized and more efficient and keep the relationship in there that I think both sides want. So if you're not building a platform that's pushing a certain type of algorithm, and if you're really heavy and you really buy into a maybe a little bit of a longer development cycle to ensure the fact that great design is going in and that you're asking customers about it and you're getting that feedback, I think that's a good hedge against bias in the technology.
Yeah. And you said something earlier about you like that the lender controls the customization. And so ideally they know their customers and they're, you know, that experience is being fed in to your point. So your point about the algorithm, thank you for that. Cause it's like, oh yeah. Yeah. That's where a lot of things get screwed up is when it's automatic or the machine is making the decisions. That's important to tease out. Thank you.
Yeah, and as much as possible, we want to try to automate once you know what your, you know, pattern is or your algorithm is. We want to help you automate that so you can move faster. But yeah, we're not really suggesting any of those to anybody.
You talked a little bit about CDFIs and PPP and technology, and that was such a huge conversation, Kit. So I would imagine that you and LenderFit were in the middle of that. So just to spell out some acronyms, CDFIs are Community Development Financial Institutions, they're community lenders, and PPP is the Payroll Protection Program, which is what the federal government rolled out in the start-ish of the pandemic of forgivable loans to small businesses, where if a small business took on a loan, and I'm paraphrasing like crazy here, took on a PPP loan and promised to maintain its payroll, that they wouldn't have to pay back that loan. So huge lifeline for small businesses. And then David was talking about if lenders don't have the technology to be able to process through those applications, there becomes a bottleneck, compounded with all other kinds of cultural issues going on with banking relationships and who gets the money and who's at the Rolodex. So can you talk a little bit about your experience working with CDFIs during PPP, where all of a sudden there was this huge influx of capital that was really designed for small businesses to succeed in this really difficult economic cash crunch time, and what you saw and what you experienced?
We didn't see any CDFI backing down from the challenge. You know, I think that's pretty cool. And as we got in front of more and more of them had kind of developed their sort of, well, let's do this and connect this and then call in everybody we know, as well as, you know, and our cousins and siblings to come and help process the capital.
I was in the middle of that myself. Yeah.
And so for a while there, towards the beginning, people were so nervous to switch their process. So they had, you know, we talked to I remember a significant conversation was with a larger lender in Georgia, and they had pulled everybody in, you know, people who had never processed an application before in their life. The whole team was in there. They're working 6 days a week. You know, the main person's working like 7 days a week, 10 hours a day. And they would see something like LenderFit and they'd be like, this is what we need. But I'm so nervous to like change in the middle of this. And so a lot of CDFIs, like a lot of mainstream lenders, kind of, you know, were just grinding it out. You know, one of the things that I like to hear when people switch, when people start using LenderFit, is that they get to take a vacation for the first time because, you know, we help them and we help make it easier for people. We make it easier for people to cover for them while they're gone.
Yeah. If I can just add a stat for, so people get a sense of volume. So the organization, that I worked for, we normally, in a normal year, 100 loans a year, and we're, you know, $500 million asset under management size, 70 employees. We went from 100 loans a year to over 500 loans in that first round of PPP. And we did it all manually through email boxes and stuff like that. Crazy. But that's the amount of volume that lenders were seeing through this process, just a fivefold.
Yeah, it was just an enormous amount. And what was neat was, I think that I've realized this over the past couple of years, that, you know, that the CDFI industry as a whole is way more dynamic and interested in adopting new technology and adopting it faster than a lot of other lenders in various layers of the industry. And so I've thought that was pretty interesting as we started LenderFit and really focused on CDFIs and nonprofit lenders, that a lot of times when they liked LenderFit, they were making that decision pretty quickly to start using LenderFit. And so that is another feather in the cap, I think, for the CDFI world, is that they're always looking and a little bit more open to trying something new than a lot of other, you know, just mainstream lenders. Same thing, I would talk with other mainstream lenders who were struggling through PPP, and a lot of smaller banks had a huge influx of customers who, you know, couldn't make it through the gates at the giant lenders. And even the smaller banks were having to turn people away because they couldn't manage the volume, you know, and it was just fascinating, because when it's hard to get new customers as a bank, and if you can help out a small business early on, they tend to stay with you. And, you know, if you can be that first person to help them out. So there was a huge missed opportunity for smaller banks where, you know, sometimes hundreds of applications were coming to them and they didn't have the manpower to do it. But regardless of everyone I spoke with, everybody was pulling people from other departments. Everybody was using anybody who was possible in their organization to try to help, you know, manage these applications. The second thing I saw that wasn't necessarily PPP lending related were a lot of communities just taking action before the PPP funding was available. So, you know, the government said, we got to do something. And then it was, well, what, like, what's the guidelines? What's the guidelines? What's the guidelines? Everybody's on there, you know, just waiting to hear. And we saw communities all around the country that were just stepping up, and instantly those foundations or the community foundation or whoever it was in the community was saying, hey, like, let's get a $3 million fund together. Let's get $1 million fund together. Let's get a $10 million fund together. And we easily saw a lot of those going live before PPP and before people really understood the guidelines, you know, around PPP. And that was really fascinating too, just from a system perspective, because it was very obvious just how much of a misunderstanding there was, how little anybody outside of the CDFI understood what it was like to apply for a loan or what it was like to run a small business and what information that person had to share. My example for this is we would inevitably see an inbound request come in and they say, hey, our city wants to do this. They don't have a loan program. They called us up because we're used to working with small businesses. Okay, great. And have you figured out your plan? Have you all agreed on exactly what you need to collect to get this approved? Yeah, we did. Okay, show it to me. Well, the list was like 100 items long. And the city was like, well, why can't you get their blood type and their a DNA sample while you're making this $5,000 loan to them? I don't understand. It's $5,000. And, you know, to which the, you know, politely the CFI said to say like, yeah, that's okay. Well, it's not that much money. And by the way, is this an emergency loan? Because if it's an emergency loan, we need to ask for like 8 things. Otherwise they're not going to get this capital for 3 months. And that was kind of the equalizer. I felt like we actually had a chance to influence some of those conversations as kind of a third party. And just to say, hey, we've seen this going on around the city. I've seen it some in my own backyard. And like, you've got to cut like at least these 12 things out of here. And a lot of times there was just a lot of missed steps where I'd say, great. So who in the city are you going to contact to verify that this small business owner is current on their taxes? And they're like, oh, well, I guess we haven't, do you think they're going to need that? I'm like, yes, any, like they're definitely going to make sure they're in good standing. And really what needs to happen is there needs to be an identified point person at the city for this emergency program who can be readily available to clear those applicants. And that's a whole week or two long process of kind of negotiating and you know, setting these things up. So I felt like, you know, as things went on, we had a decent blueprint to say, okay, have you done this, this, and this? Okay, great. Now let's start working together. And so, but it was, again, you know, having been in this industry, been in the microlending space, trying to, you know, create these solutions and create these systems, it was really disheartening to hear all of this confusion around the country and to hear these cities that had small business loan programs and had, entire groups of people trying to help small businesses and bring them to town and attract them. And, it was just kind of a shock that it was hard for small businesses to apply for capital. So that was just an eye opener for me. Unfortunately, a lot of times a smaller amount, there's even more information that people want than if you're providing a larger amount.
Yeah, I partner with some localities here in Virginia around some of that work. And, the conversation is, you know, your public dollars are like they get the banker on the EDA board, or they have the one that used to be a lender, and they're kind of really low risk tolerance. And it's like, this is public money. You know, for this type of work, you're taking the risk that the public or the private sector won't take or can't take. So kind of even shifting the mindset around these kind of taxpayer dollars, helping taxpayers stay in business, you know, and that type of shift in their what they're asking for and how they're even approving the deals is fascinating sometimes.
Yeah. And we would see a spike, you know, the closer to a deadline of needing to get that capital out. Because I think everybody got it and they're like, now what exactly can we use this for? And then it's like, oh no, it's getting closer to the deadline. Like, we have to use this or lose it. And then all of a sudden, you know, like all these inbound requests. it was similar. The last round of PPP, there was a carve out for CDFIs, and it was fascinating. The very last month we saw activity on the platform just spike because every bank was like, we can't do anything. Go find one of these CDFIs. We don't know what that is, but Google CDFI and go find a CDFI. And yeah, so I will say, you know, all of the lack of awareness around CDFIs, I think that what has, you know, the silver lining or some making lemonade out of this lemon of COVID is that, you know, CDFIs, I think, are going to enter into a really great era. You know, another thing that we have perspective on is how many large corporations now are trying to set up partnerships with larger CDFIs and, the MasterCards of the world, the Visas, the Starbucks, you know, how they're all interested in how do we get capital out to BIPOC-owned businesses and women-owned businesses. And those folks weren't knocking down the door in 2017. And so what's really neat about kind of rising out of the ashes is the world's starting to pay more attention. And just so many more people do know now about what a CDFI is and what their role is and what they've been doing for the last, you know, couple decades. And so I think the next 5 to 10 years are going to be really exciting, and we're going to see more and more outcomes and amazing work from CDFIs now that the awareness has been created.
CDFI is an overnight sensation, 40 years in the making.
Yeah. That's right.
Welcome
that's
to
right.
2022.
We say that it's one of the most unfortunate secrets that we have in the country, you know. It is true that now my family kind of understands the organization I work for. Even though I've been saying the acronym for years, but they're like, "Oh, I get it now. I heard about it in the news." It's like,
oh, that's great.
So, David, to wrap up our interview, we always ask our guests the same question, and the answers are always phenomenal. And we look forward to hearing your answer as well. How do you define a renegade?
It's easy to be a renegade without a mission. and so I think that a real renegade is someone who has an actual mission and is really willing to kind of see things through, see the change through to the end that they're trying to work on. Similar to small businesses. Small business owners go to Thanksgiving, they go to Christmas, and their families are like, "Go get a real job. What are you doing? Like, why are you doing this?" And, you know, that's the same experience with the renegade. Like, if you're trying to change the system, if you're trying to make something happen, you know, there are just so many people that are going to tell you to give up. And so, yeah, I think a true renegade is someone who has a mission and kind of perseveres to the end.
Fantastic answer. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So Chance, our skeptic going in about technology use for good, what'd you think?
Broken the fourth wall. I don't know what I'm allowed to say, but I'm not allowed to say anymore.
You can say whatever you want to say. Break the fourth wall down.
I'm going to maintain kind of like where I was before.
Okay.
In that it's still very focused on the process and what it is that the lender is wanting to do. So like David brought up the example of the municipality that wants someone's blood type to extend them a loan of $5,000. And it's like, well, why? I can't tell you my blood type right now. I just can't. If I ever needed to give some of my blood type in order to get capital, that is going to be like at least a 2-week long process while I figure that out. I definitely still maintain that it's about people and process more so than the technology, but I'm glad that there are technologists like David who are actually interested in that process and seems to be willing to have harder conversation with their clients about, is this kind of thing really necessary?
Stephanie, what did you think?
I appreciated his story at the very beginning. I think about Sherry, who was the caterer. And long story short, Sherry couldn't get any traction anywhere else. So she just went online and got a loan. And so to me, that also shows the importance of convenience for people and how important the technology is in order to get to somebody before you know, predatory loan or lender does, right? I think at the end of the day, you've got to kind of, as an industry, you have to gauge who's your competition and how are they getting their clients.
Yeah. I keep going back to, Ebony, what you said about technology being seen as a luxury for CDFI, I'm speaking for myself personally, but seeing, and so my perception of it was CDFI is seeing technology as, well, that's a luxury. That would make our jobs easier, but let's just grind it out instead. But it also limits you to the volume that you're able to take on. It also limits your staff who may be feeling burnt out after 2 years of grinding it out. And so, like, at what point does technology and, like, okay, we have to use this expense to get technology? Because if we don't, to your point, our clients, we're not able to provide the services and the basic financial tools that our clients need, and they're forced to go somewhere else or give up their dream, or give up their economic potential, or give up their livelihood. And so at what point does technology tip from being a luxury to being a necessity? I think we've made that a really hard tipping point of when do we decide to invest in our infrastructure versus using that money to push out into our communities through, you know, more technical assistance or a lower interest rate or a grant dollar.
Let's see. I think the way that you just described that as when do we use that as infrastructure versus pushing it out to our communities, I don't think it's an either or. I think it's a combination. And you use technology, that's also a tool to push out into communities.
Sometimes. A lot of times CDFIs are run off the back of Excel.
Yeah.
And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't work. And, like, what's that tipping balance? I think there is often a big cultural positioning of technology. I have a theory that there's an old school mentality and a new school mentality in CDFIs of how we think about CDFIs and how we think about lending and how we run an organization. And I think technology is really important. And how do we use this for good? How do we use this to accelerate lending into our communities? And sometimes, you know, it's worked for a long time as it is to run it off the back of Excel and QuickBooks. And so I think every CDFI has a different position on it and how it works.
Well, and even like in a post-COVID environment now too, and we're worried about talent and workforce, and we have these virtual settings. And if you don't have, and if relationships and the human experience is a priority, consistent information where everybody, and I'm just coming from my car sales experience, you know, like where you have a CRM or a client relationship management system. And so whether it's me or you, you know, Chance comes in to, you know, he was in on Monday and talked to Leah and I wrote my notes, and then I'm not there on Wednesday when he comes back, but Andrea can pick up and the customer service is there and the client is cared for because the information is accessible and regardless of where you sit in the organization. So
yeah,
that is, like, I think going to be a requirement going forward because we want people that want to be in the work and they don't want to have to come to an office and they don't, you know, so there's going to be that, I think there's, to your point, there's going to be that tipping point of organizations that keep up and can keep their workforce and attract talent because they're more flexible and they have the tools to do their jobs from their phone, from their laptop. And I had a camping trip. Like, we had a colleague that lived in an RV for the last year, and I don't think anybody knew that he sold his house and was on the road. But, you know, it didn't matter, right? Because he was doing his job. Like, but that's going to make or break some of these organizations. And someone that, you know, Joe Smith's Excel sheet from 20 years ago ain't going to do it after, you know, after a certain point. Because Joe retired and he didn't take notes and no one else knows how to use it. But that's where all the clients are. Like, I mean, like that's what's going to break, you know?
What David's doing with LenderFit is so radically simple. If I were him and going in to pitch this, I would feel intimidated or scared about looking like an idiot because of just the simplicity of it. And to be willing to stand up and say, yeah, it's simple, but it works. And the complexity of it, not even complexity of it, but the depth of it is that it listened to communities. It listened to small business owners. It didn't just listen to the lenders and listened with empathy of, like, how is this actually working for you? And how could it work better? And what is your experience like? I think there's something that you have to be brave to do. Chance, I think you're going to have your work cut out for you on editing this one.
Yeah. In short, everybody, technology is a land of contrasts.
Do you like listening to Renegade Capital Podcast? Great, we are here for you. For even more information about upcoming episodes, speakers that we would love to have as a moonshot, or even next steps that you can take to move your money in a direction that you feel proud of, subscribe to our weekly newsletter at renegadecapitalpodcast.com/subscribe.